Howdy and welcome to the show. I'm Miles Cooper. Cooper's Code focuses on legal issues and notable practitioners, distilling wisdom so we all achieve the best results for our clients. Welcome to part two of what is a wonderful two-part interview with Chris Beeman. I'm really looking forward to sharing this with you. Enjoy the show. Chris is a nationally renowned trial lawyer at Clapp, Maroney, Lucinich, Beeman, and Shelley. Having been on the other side of the V from Chris on a few cases, I can say he's the type of lawyer one says great and crap in equal parts when he shows up in a case. Great because he's friendly, professional, knows what to fight over and what not to, and his entire team is a pleasure to work with. Crap for almost all the same reasons. He's an effective advocate whose intelligence, charm, and team management combine to make him a devastating opponent. Crap is the opposite of his work product, although through his work, he's developed a granular understanding of chicken feces, which I suspect we may touch on today. Unafraid of trial, with a never-let-them-see-me-sweat approach, he's collected an impressive record of defense verdicts, having tried over 100 cases to verdict. He's been inducted into the Big Four invitation-only prestigious organizations, the American Board of Trial Advocates, known as ABOTA, the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, the American College of Trial Lawyers, and the International Society of Barristers. Chris recently finished serving as the national president of the ABOTA Foundation. He's also received the Donnie Bailey Award for Civility, Professionalism, and Integrity, as well as the Distinguished Defense Trial Lawyer of the Year Award from the San Francisco Trial Lawyers Association. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks, Miles.
Taking it back to the beginning of the case, plaintiff's lawyers are sometimes told that if the defense lawyer or the adjuster isn't given X type of information within the first 30 days or 60 days, that they have to fill it in themselves. And as a result, the authority at the outset may not be set high enough. And if it's not set high enough at the beginning, it becomes really quite hard as you move forward to make changes. Is there any truth to that?
I can't really speak to the reserving because that's something I really do try to stay away from because I know the insurance industry has requirements about reserves and they can get in trouble if they're not reserving things appropriately. When a new file comes in, I believe in the three C's, which is contacting the carrier immediately to either say thank you or to talk about the file or just to introduce yourself if it's a new client. And then contacting opposing counsel. I try to do that all the time, just to intro and say, I'll be handling this case and that we haven't worked together before, but if there are things that you would like informally, please give me a call. And if it's appropriate, I'll get you what you need. And I hope you would do the same thing. Because what we're doing, if you think about it as a defense lawyer, you receive a file, pretty much no information. And one of the major things will be, and even who I assign to help me on a case or assign the case to, is going to be dictated by the exposure. You can get a look at a demand from an LA lawyer that says, this is worth $5 million and it's worth like $35,000. So I like to contact the lawyer. I definitely slandered all the lawyers there. Sorry about that. I contact the lawyer to say, would you mind providing me whatever medical bills you have? I mean, I'm going to get them in subpoena by subpoenaing them. So it'd be great if I could have those up front to get an understanding of what we're dealing with here. People that want their adversary to know what the case is about will just do that. Helps everybody.
That was going to be kind of my next area of questioning is, at the outset, if you're trying to look good for your client, the carrier, and you're trying to properly evaluate the case, what is it that we can give you on our side? As you said, we're going to have to give you stuff anyway. What is it helpful to have kind of preloaded so that you can make your initial status report as thorough and comprehensive as possible?
That would be a blessing. It does not happen very often. But when I get into a case and want to learn about it, I mean, the first way is to talk to counsel and just say, tell me what you can. Overview. How's your client doing? What's still treating? What's the status of the injury? Is he or she working? You know, just to start building a rapport with somebody that you're going to deal with for a year or so and maybe end up in trial against. And also gathering the information the carrier needs, which is always to identify the diagnosis of the injuries. What residuals are there? What are the medical specials? What does the person do for a living? If you have a packet of some wage documents, they always want to have the income tax stuff, which pretty much plaintiff's lawyers never give, although sometimes there's a reason to do that. So, you know, the more you can give them that has to do with numbers, the better. I mean, I know, obviously, there are cases like a burn case or a brain injury case that the economics are not going to equate to the value. There's going to be a wrongful death case is even a better example. And you can't evaluate one of those until you have an understanding of the relationship between the decedent and the plaintiff. I mean, it's just impossible. People ask to do, what do you think the value is? Well, haven't even met the plaintiff, don't know anything about how often they saw his or her father or mother or whoever the decedent is. So those are a little harder at the get-go, but I have a case right now, the Good Firm in San Jose, and they're putting together a video. I said, we could start in discovery. We could get on the discovery treadmill, and that's what it is, you know, interrogatories and document requests and subpoenas and IMEs. But what, you want to just talk and exchange information? And they said, yeah, we actually are going to put together a video for you so you can understand that this is a Hispanic worker who was killed when a tree unfortunately fell on a road where he was just happened to be driving by at the time. And his mother is in Mexico. So that's really helps everybody. They're going to video her and put together some information. I don't have it yet. I hope they do it. They said they would. Knock on wood again.
I imagine they probably will if they're a good firm.
Yes.
As we talk through the initial material, and this is a little bit of a pivot, there has been a change that just came out in January of this year with the new rule of mandatory initial disclosures. And I know a lot of us with our firms are figuring out how are we going to handle this change, because within 60 days of receiving a demand, one is obligated to turn over a lot of stuff that otherwise before this wasn't required. Have you evaluated that within the firm, within your practice group, and made any decisions about how you're going to be setting the stage to be able to deal with that, both proactively and then also in reaction?
I'm still trying to understand the requirement, honestly. I think there are exceptions to when you have to do that. So I'm aware of that. That has not impacted any of my cases so far, but I know it will. I'm a member of the ADC, which is the Association of Defense Counsel, and there's a good newsletter, and that was one of the things. There are two major changes in January 2024. That's one of them, and there's another one about experts and causation for defense experts, and I frankly don't know that much about either of them yet.
I have a friend who is thrilled to have his case get continued to 2024 because he's like, now I can use this. Yeah.
I bet.
As we kind of move down the road on cases, so we've got the initial introduction with the plaintiff's lawyer, we've got material that would be helpful for you and kind of a rapport of, look, you know, if you can give me some stuff, it will help me with the carrier. We were doing some stuff within the firm today. Does it get as granular as ICD-9 or 10 codes where you want that level of diagnosis, or are the medical records sufficient?
Medical records are great. I will say the other thing, and this may be true only to me, but pictures really help me, even pictures of the plaintiff. And I know, like, the brief that you did on the bike case that we had in Truckee, it was great because I got a demand package before the brief, and there were pictures of what this guy looked like on his bike and when he was playing golf, and it's so helpful to get pictures. A lot of us are visual learners, and I think it really does help implant something in your head, embed, okay, this guy looks like that. He looks like a good person. And the more we get, the better, and particularly pictures for me.
When we get to the point of mediation, I know that different carriers, different, whether you're representing a private individual or private company, there may be different timelines for how far in advance you need to work with that client to set the right level of authority. Is there a time frame where you feel you have to receive the briefing, the material, 1 week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks beforehand in order to be able to have a meaningful conversation on authority?
The kind of cases that we're used to handling, where there's a life care plan or where there's some complicated earning capacity claim, it's really helpful to get those reports as early as possible. So it can't come early enough, those things, because that's where the hangup is on the larger exposure cases, is having our economists look at the loss of earning calculations and calculating present cash value and such. The life care plans are even more important to get early, because those, obviously, speaking of granular, always have information that you need an expert to help understand. I do. So you can't turn those over soon enough. And a lot of times people are a little leery about that because they don't want to be locked into an opinion or a number. But, you know, that could be massaged later because that was a draft and it was a preliminary report or however it might be labeled. Rule of thumb, this is how we do it. And I think it's been relatively successful, at least in terms of format, is that if a mediation is set on June 1st, we back 30 days before that, mandatory, have an evaluation, specific number to the carrier. And we do it, you know, there's a gross number. This is like the value of the injury, but with comparative or with whatever Prop 51 or whatever might apply. This is what we want you to bring. And they generally listen, certainly not always. And there's some, you know, pretty sophisticated folks that are going to disagree and give you less money, or some are going to give you more money because they think that you've under-evaluated the case. So that goes out May 1st. My team, I think I have 10 lawyers working on my team right now. And with the paralegals, we're about 15 people. And on almost every case, we have a round table meeting where we sit around a table. It's not round, but it is a round table meeting. And it's paralegals, lawyers, and we talk. Somebody presents it. Usually it's the handling attorney presents the case, shows pictures, you know, talks about the impressions that the witnesses make, goes through the whole case. And it could go from a half hour to an hour. We don't usually spend more than an hour because we are hourly people. So, and we can't all bill for that. That's another bane of the carrier existence. But anyway, we do round tables and then we pull people, and I'll bring somebody, the receptionist and a legal assistant, and try to round it out, because mostly defense lawyers and defense paralegals are probably going to have a particular perspective. But that really helps get a feel. That's not a mock trial. It's not a focus group, but it's a, you know, collective wisdom versus somebody saying, well, this is what I think this case is worth. It's a bunch of people bouncing it off each other. So what can you do to help that process is just give us the reports as soon as you can.
When I'm hearing that this session is happening about a month beforehand, is it helpful to have the mediation brief? I understand the reports are helpful, but is it helpful to have the mediation brief before you're having this meeting? So meaning get the brief out 6 weeks instead of 4 weeks?
That would be ideal. I'm not sure how that would work because it never happens, honestly. But because typically I'll get a brief between 10 days and a week beforehand, maybe. And that's from very good law firms. So it would be a luxury to get it in advance of the roundtable, because then we could really make a good presentation. When we do our internal roundtables, we're, you know, talking about the bad parts of the case as well as the good, for sure, just like a mock trial, because we want to have an honest reaction about the value. And most of the time, in a typical case, you can kind of anticipate what the claims will be, even if they're not in a brief yet, because you've done depositions and discovery and all that stuff.
Part of the reason I've been stuck on this is because years and years ago, I thought we were always doing it right. And then I went to a presentation where Bill Smith was talking, and he was talking about how they get their briefs out anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks in advance. They talk to the defense team and say, when do you need it by in order to make your decisions? And that when there are excess or multiple excess layers, for each excess, you should be thinking about an additional 2 weeks in terms of the number of carriers, which means you're getting your brief out like 2 months in advance, which was back then, you know, I thought 2 weeks in advance, we were doing our job well.
And I think you are at 2 weeks, honestly. Bill's suggestion is it's great. Again, the more information we have, the earlier, the better job we can do running it up the ladder. I'm not sure that's a realistic expectation on all cases, but I agree that especially, I didn't really think of the excess because we deal with cases where there's a tower of insurance a lot of the times. But we're reporting to everybody almost from the beginning. If you make a demand to me in a case and the demand's $10 million, then I'm going to report up to 15, right? Or I'll figure out what the layers are up to 15. But if there, a lot of times, and this happened recently, it was another slanderous statement about LA lawyers. It was like one of those, whatever your policy limits are, we want it. And it was a decent sized case.
Okay.
Well, I had this for a really large construction company, and they have a huge tower of insurance, like $100 million, maybe even more. I had to report to everybody. I was like, this is stupid. There's no way on God's earth this will be worth, you know, anywhere near what I'm reporting to. And the higher you go up, you get an automatic response. It's like, you know, this is notice only. Don't copy us anymore. And then eventually you figure out where you really need to report. But that is a little bit of a complication. So it's good to get a demand which actually has a number in it, typically.
So that then brings me to interactions with, say, coverage counsel or recalcitrant layers. Do you end up in situations where, you know, your job is for the client, but, you know, in this tower, the layer between 25 and 50 is saying, hell no, we're not getting hit. And everyone above is like, yeah, we're getting hit. And you have to work with coverage counsel or a carrier there. Have you had those situations?
Yes. And typically by that point, you've got personal counsel involved. If I have this for a carrier and there's an issue with one of the layers ignoring the real value of the case, the reality is that the layers above that layer, so if it's up to $10 million with, let's say, Chubb, and then AIG has 15 on top of that, if Chubb is not playing ball, AIGs will pound them. They'll be all over them. So a lot of times the excess carrier do the work, or the excess carrier does the work so that the layer below them becomes more realistic. If they're not, we can write and try to shake people up, but usually when there's a carrier involved in paying our fees, it's better to have an independent personal counsel do some of the dirty work, whether it's on the primary layer or up the tower.
That makes a lot of sense. As we bounce around and talk about various pieces, you, as I understand it, tried over 100 cases to verdict.
I'm glad you said that. I want to clarify one thing. I've defended cases brought by more than 100 plaintiffs. I think my trial counts like 55 or something like that, but I've had a lot of, I think one of them we're going to talk about is a trial that involved a right to farm issue. And that had like 24. So the 100 is a little puffy.
I see. Okay.
Yes.
Well, what I will say is that in today's era, lawyers who have tried more than 10 cases are kind of hard to come by. So 55, 100, 300, anything north of 20, I think is something to be quite proud of.
It's been good.
Yeah.
It's been good.
So on the interesting trial cases, and I mentioned to you, we did a little bit of homework before you came aboard. I understand that you had a case, a right to farm case. Some people refer to it as the chicken shit case. And I think we've just got a explicit rating slapped onto this particular episode of the podcast there. Tell us a little bit about that case and both the granularity of the case itself, but also why you feel it came together in the way it did and the learnings from a trial lawyer perspective in terms of what worked and what didn't.
Happy to. The way the case came to me was unique. There had been a trial in federal court a few years previously between the same parties. There's a lot of detail and I don't want to get too bogged down in it, but I'll give a little overview. But what might be entertaining is that I received a call from a claims professional that I knew well. And he said, have you ever handled any right to farm cases? I was like, absolutely. He's like, what the fuck is a right to farm case? Now we definitely have explicit.
We've hit the explicit one. Yep.
So
good to go.
You can take that out if you want to, but that is what I said.
It means
myself.
My kids will live to listen to it.
Yes. Anyway, I looked up right to farm and it was a case where it started out two very fine plaintiff lawyers. They were trying cases that were called CAFO, which is a confined animal feeding operation. And they tried them all over the country. And our case was a ranch, which was a chicken ranch. And it was in French Camp, which is out in the Central Valley.
Did you drive through on your way to Yosemite?
Exactly. So it was in French Camp. The issue was that I think the guy had 700,000 chickens on his ranch. And I think they generated, and I'm not exaggerating, like a ton of manure a day that, of course, drew flies, and the odor was not pleasant, and it was really, really dusty. And so there had been a case tried previously by counsel, and I did not try that case, in federal court, and the claims were, it was a nuisance claim. And what I learned when I was learning what right to farm defense was, I was also learning about the law of nuisance. By the way, there's almost no jury verdicts that have to do with nuisance because it's typically a court trial. So I learned that too, because we had lots of things to catch up on. There were 24 neighbors that sued for nuisance of dust and smell. This is gross, but the guy had what was called a manure lagoon on his property. And I have to laugh because I had to go out and do site inspections. And I
was going to ask you, was this one of the Tahoe-like site inspection experiences, or was this different?
No, it was a lot.
Did you go swimming in the manure lagoon?
It's the other end of the spectrum than that. But it's funny because I met a consultant out there one time. We had to go out over and over again. And the consultant, he called me the next day. He goes, you know, my wife wouldn't even let me come in the house because of the smell of my clothes after that. It was so bad. How do you do this? I go, and anyway, the things about that case, it did go to trial. Something that was kind of entertaining, I thought, was my client, between the two trials, had planted an almond orchard that was it looked really great. I mean, it helped the optics of the whole case. It wasn't before Google, for sure, Google Maps, but we did have a photographer to do flyovers showing that, which the jury really appreciated because it looked really nice.
As in a before-after juxtaposition, he's a good neighbor, look what he did?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. And the right to farm defense basically says that farmers have the right to farm, and if somebody complains about, it's almost coming to the nuisance defense, but it gives the farmers great latitude in conducting their business. And as long as they're doing that in accord with standards, then they cannot be liable.
I'm thinking of an analogy, and tell me if this works or doesn't. There's the increasing the inherent risk of a sport. We were talking about that with the bicycle case.
Uh-huh.
If the farmer does something that increases the pestilence beyond normal farming, is that the standard?
It's more that there is they compare the way the operation is run with other like organizations. So it's almost like a standard of care issue. And if you meet the standard of care, basically like a negligence argument, the problem with our case was that there were no other ranches that had 700,000 chickens and generated a ton of manure per day.
Isn't Foster Farms like two blocks away from there?
No, you know, but it was funny. I'll tell you a story about one of the lawyers that tried the case was this guy from Savannah. And I could tell you 100 stories about him. He was extremely entertaining, very good on his feet. There was local counsel who was also very talented. There was a lawyer from Kansas City. There was at one point, and this is a learning lesson. I was about 2 months ahead out from trial. And the case had been continued and always ruined a vacation and always ruined a holiday. And about 2 months before, you know, I said, I got to get somebody to try this case with me. So I asked my partner, Ted Shelley, who's now retired. I said, look, can you jump in with me? And he said, sure. So we split up the case and I did liability and he did damages. And it worked out really well. So that's one lesson is like, when you're overburdened with a case like that, it really never was a one lawyer case.
Buried in crap.
Yeah, exactly. So
the jokes just write themselves.
Oh, there's like, they go on and on in this case. But the lawyer from Savannah had a very, very thick accent. Y'all Anna, he'd say. And he was a great lawyer. And the local council had done a motion limine. It was like the anti-carpetbagger motion. So we were not allowed to suggest that this lawyer was not from the Bay Area. So we're in chambers with a really great judge in Santa Clara. And we're going through the motions limiting, and we get to the one about the, you know, you can't mention that he's from Georgia. And the judge kind of giggles a little. He goes, you know, don't you think the jury's going to figure this out? Don't you think they'll know right away? As soon as he opens his mouth and the lawyer from Savannah says, Your Honor, we'll withdraw that motion. And I said, Your Honor, we would like to join that motion and preclude counsel for plaintiff from ever speaking during the trial. So we're having a good chuckle in chambers like this.
Yeah.
And then the guy from Savannah goes, I have two ex-wives who will stipulate that I should not speak. It was really
character.
He was a character. And it was actually a really long trial. And we were successful at that. Right to farm defense carried the day. I had a fantastic expert who explained that all that manure, the ton a day of manure, actually was beneficial to our ecosystem because it could be used for fertilizer and other people. You know, the benefits of the not only the eggs, which we weren't allowed to talk about for some reason, but the benefit of the fertilizer that came from the manure was kind of what won the case for us. So as you've kind of alluded to, I went into the case as a trialer and I came out as a chicken shit lawyer. So not sure that's exactly, I don't have that on my business card, but you know.
Maybe on the other side?
Maybe. Maybe I give that a go.
A common question that I'm always fascinated by, and again, it's the venue selection. So this sounds like it should have been in, I believe, San Joaquin County in terms of the principal place of business. How did you find yourself in what I understand to be Santa Clara County for this?
Yeah, another great question. So when they tried that in federal court, what happened was that must have been tried in Sacramento. And they didn't like their jury pool, right? Because it's too ag-oriented in Central Valley. And the person who ran and owned the ranch, his business was out of San Jose. They thought they would have more success in that venue because it's more urban. And they thought they would not relate to the agricultural angle that we had. And, you know, that we had a really good jury, had a great, really good jury pick on that one. And that certainly helped. We mocked that case also. So that helped us get our jury profile that who we wanted to be with us there.
If you had the case split between you and Ted, how did you handle the jury selection?
We kind of rotated on stuff. They went on for a long time. It was a 7-week trial. The local counsel did the pick. I did the pick. And then the judge allowed us to split our openings so we could each talk during opening. And then we just did our witnesses based on that, which worked out fairly well. If Ted ever hears this thing, he'll remember that I did most of the heavy lifting because it was really all about the liability part. But the damages was also, he handled that really well. I wanted to mention, though, that so the Savannah guy, one of the landmarks, there's a Ghirardelli factory out there, right? So that was used as a reference point sometimes. And so whenever he used it, he would say, the Ghirardelli factory is about a mile away. And so the whole thing about, you know, being able to communicate, speak to the jury in a way, using the language correctly, pronouncing, you know, local landmarks, it was not that they held that against him, but we actually kind of made a little bit of fun of it in a nice way, I hope, because we don't want to make fun of anybody in front of a jury because that doesn't usually work very well.
No, it usually backfires on you.
Ghirardelli, yes.
We touched a little bit about things that you learned from that trial. Are there things, as you look on your practice now, that you would want to have younger lawyers who are listening to this absorb? For example, things that you might have done differently, ways that you got trials in a, has come to be somewhat of a trial desert in the post-Discovery Act, post-ADR world. Wisdom would you share with them?
First, I would say that it's important to go to a firm that tries cases. And sometimes that's not a civil litigation firm. Sometimes that's a DA's office or a PD's office. I think if you want to be a trial lawyer, you have to be in the right setting to meet your goals. If you get into that setting, I think it's important to, when you're communicating with your client, to do so in a way that doesn't always suggest you want to get rid of the case. And I know that sounds simple, but in, you know, the carriers and the clients are always looking at, well, what will this cost to try the case? How much is your time going to be? And if we lose, so they're always looking at kind of that bottom line. And I think it's really important for young lawyers to evaluate cases in a way that'll allow them to get to trial. And we do that. If you could settle a case for $750, but you think it's only worth $350, then tell them it's worth $350. And don't say, hey, it could go worse. And waffling on the value. And things change. And, you know, as you get closer to trial, usually the case gets more valuable if you're a defense lawyer. And especially the value stays low if it's somebody else's file. But if it's yours, the value goes up in your head as you get closer to trial. So you have to position yourself to try a case by communicating confidently what the value is without waffling. And by the way, carriers hate that. They hate when you, nothing changes, but your evaluation goes up a few $100,000, you know, because you want to go on a family vacation, which you should do. Hopefully you just get a motion to continue and you could do both. And we haven't really talked about life balance, and I did want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, if this is the right time to insert that, because it's obvious from the way that you talk about your family and your coming grandchildren that you have made that a priority as well. And so the balance of being a trial lawyer and being a member of the family as opposed to just somebody who occasionally shows up.
Yes, I think it is a good thing to talk about. And one thing I would say is you're married to a lawyer, so it's a little bit different. Marianne understands this. And obviously, the support of your family is really critical. But we put them through some really challenging stuff. And you probably get put that through because you're a spouse of a trial lawyer too. So I'm not. And I know you're just the same way as you become so focused during trial. That's all there is. That's, you know, sleep is kind of hard to come by and your mind is always going hard and you're always thinking about how you can present your evidence or take advantage of whatever situation you're in. And it's consuming. It's really a rush. It's like going on a good swim or taking a bike ride, good bike ride where you get a good endorphin rush. But there's a great sense of accomplishment to trial law, which is why I love it. But there are people that suffer as a result of that, or at least tolerate. And the thing I wanted to say about life balance, I was thinking about this because I was talking to somebody who has young kids on the way here. And I remember it was pretty easy to have good life balance when our kids were young. I mean, it really was because I had a great role model. My dad, my mom, they went to all my basketball games and they were on the sidelines and everything. So I was like, I'm going to do that. And when your kids are young and in the house, I think that really helps you with your life balance because you don't want to go to the office on weekends if you were inclined to do so otherwise because you've got a game or you've got a, if you want to do something with your kids. And that's great. I honestly feel like it gets harder when your kids get out of the house and you've got to have a great hobby like you do with cycling. And there's got to be something where it's not all about work all the time. And that's an ongoing debate for me, for sure.
It seems like you do have good hobbies. It also seems from the outsider's perspective that you've kind of doubled down on your approach to the practice because not only do you have the role within the firm and trying cases and leading a team, you also have gotten very involved in Ibota with the Ibota Foundation and a national role there. Is that part of what you're talking about in terms of being kind of sucked into giving more back to the practice?
This is the way I look at that. And thanks for, because I did want to talk a little bit about the whole ABOTA that you and I are both involved in and have been for years. And that's obviously a group of trial lawyers that have tried a minimum of 10 cases. And it's a nomination-only process, so you can't apply in San Francisco. Somebody has to nominate you and vouch for you, basically. But you know what's great about that is, I was laughing at myself a little bit earlier, I've been involved in a couple of presentations. They call them masters in trial. That's a little bit of an exaggeration if I'm in it. But I've been lucky enough to make a closing argument against Cynthia McGuinn, who's highly skilled, obviously a great mutual friend of ours, yours and mine.
I describe her as my law mom.
There you go. Perfect. That was actually during the pandemic. We did that in a courtroom, and it was a wrongful death case. So we just did closing argument. And it was great to do that in a mock trial setting because I lost, but there was no money exchanged. And I had the same great fortune. Another year, I did a closing argument against Mike Kelly. If you're going to get pantsed by Mike Kelly, it's best to do it in a mock trial setting, I would say. But ABOTA has opened a lot of doors and it's, you know, really resulted in some very good friendships. A lot of my friends are plaintiff lawyers, which I don't tell many carriers that, but so I hope no carriers are listening to this, but have really gained a lot of respect for the difficulties and challenges that are on the plaintiff side that, you know, hope you're hearing about some of the defense challenges. And I know you've kind of got a different set of those challenges. But the year that I just finished as the foundation president for ABOTA, it was by no means a sabbatical. It was a new challenge, which required me to go around the country and make presentations about the programs that we're running and do some fundraising, which is not a natural thing for a defense lawyer to do, is ask for money. But it was really rewarding. And one thing I did want to mention is we have the Jury Appreciation Movement is about a foundation program that started in Orange County with a Jury Appreciation Luncheon and has really blossomed into more of a movement, including providing juries with some swag stickers and stuff to show that we really appreciate what they do for our system of civil justice.
We can put it in the show notes.
We're certainly happy to take contributions on that. And really the whole purpose of that is to thank the jurors for doing what's so important to our system of civil justice, because without jurors, you know, there's not a jury system. The Seventh Amendment allows us to have our disputes resolved by a jury of our peers. And I found that to be really rewarding. And I will say, honestly, my year's over. I'm not the president anymore. I'm in a great club, the Past President's Club. And I'm still very involved in that movement and I want to continue to be. But stepping back and being busy with foundation stuff for a year has given me a nice perspective on, here's the part about law that I like, going back to really practicing full time. I mean, I kept my caseload last year, but I really was lucky that I danced around some trials in 2023. So thanks for letting me plug that a little bit.
Well, and given how busy you are, thanks for making your way up to Tahoe so that we could have a meaningful mediation on our case.
Absolutely. That had to be in person.
As we kind of come into the final stretch here, is there anything else that you would want to bring forward or cover that you feel that lawyers listening out there might benefit from?
Yes. And that would be a story about Miles Cooper.
Does this involve swimming?
It does not. Oh, that you tell that one.
Well, one should never underestimate the strength of competitive trial lawyers. So trying to go out and swim with a couple of fantastic swimmers in Hawaii, you and Don Carlson, I found myself gasping for air. So
we briefly humbled Miles, but he bounced back. That's for sure.
I stay on land now.
And that actually kind of goes to my story. So you and I had a case, I don't know if you remember, this was about 10 years ago. So we were seeing each other a lot on whatever case, I can't remember which case it was. But you did confess this story, which was obviously you're a super avid cyclist. And you had, I think this might be demented in some levels, but you had ridden your bike from San Francisco to Santa Cruz at night to take a deposition of a doctor. And you were humble enough to confess what happened. You rode your bike overnight, checked into a hotel room, I think, got a little bit of sleep, and then you're going to ride back to San Francisco. That's what, 60 miles, 55?
Yeah, it's a ways.
And you went down the coast. So when you arrived at the hotel, you realized that you had forgotten your
shoes.
Yes, you did. So it's a good thing that you had your bike cleats on so that you could click your way into the doctor's office, because it was not a remote deposition. And announce that you were there by sounding like a tap dancer as you walked into deposition. So that left a mark on me, and it let me know that you were somebody that was good-humored and willing to take a look at yourself and share that with others. So I remember that story for a long time.
It was an awkward feeling walking into that deposition, but as I've gotten older, I'm just kind of able to let things go.
That was when we wore suits to depositions, yep, and ties, and there you go, I was clacking in.
Suit and cleats.
Yeah. So thank you for letting me share that with your audience, and really appreciate you inviting me. I've enjoyed talking to you, and like you were nice enough to make some complimentary remarks about B. You have a great law firm, really like dealing with you, and I don't love paying you a lot of money, but that comes with the territory when you got a good lawyer on the other side.
I always enjoy our engagements. I really enjoyed our conversation. So look forward to many more years of it.
Great. Good luck.
Yeah, you too. And thank you for listening today. Please email us at podcast@coopers.law with questions, comments, feedback, and suggestions on how you would approach a right-to-farm case. Like what you heard? Share us with a colleague and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. To all of you doing justice out there, happy hunting.